Last time we introduced the notion of tangent space. And I said beforehand that there are three ways to define the tangent space. One of them is the algebraic, the other is the physicist's way to do this, and the third is the geometric way of defining the tangent space. So far, we defined the tangent space algebraically, namely in two steps. First, we identified direction vectors with directional derivatives, because both are choosing a direction. Second, derivatives can be identified as linear maps which obey the product rule. Today, we'll do the other two definitions of tangent space, because they are also very useful and intuitive. And throughout this course, we will need all three of those definitions. so we might as well do them right away. So let's start with the physicist's definition of what a tangent space to a point P of a differential manifold is. For that, let me remind you of the general setup. We have a differential manifold that we call M. And then we said that the points of the manifold could be addressed to by giving them human names, for example, or enumerating them A, B, C, but that's super inconvenient. So what we do is we define a differentiable invertible map, a diffeomorphism, into Rn. Maybe not all of it at once, but in patches. So we have charts that form an atlas. And as a consequence, each point P is then mapped by means of a chart into a point in Rn. And those guys have names, namely n tuples of numbers. Then we also considered the function space, or more precisely, the algebra of function germs at the point P. And correspondingly, there is also an algebra of function germs at the point Q in Rn. And it turns out that the diffeomorphism phi induces an algebra homomorphism between those two. And since these are bijections, even though the arrows go one way and then here the other way, doesn't matter, we can always invert those matrices, these maps as well. So what we have is that not only does every point in the manifold have an image in Rn because of this chart, but also every function germ on Rn at Q has an image which is a function germ of a function on the manifold at the point P. And this chart, this diffeomorphism, induces a map from the function germs on Rn to the function germs on the manifold. And since this is invertible, we can also say that every function germ in here has a name or a pre-image here among the function germs on Rn. And then we considered the tangent vector space. Tangent vectors, according to the algebraic definition, are linear maps that map these function germs into real numbers, namely the directional derivative of the function at that point. So the tangent vectors are linear maps that map function germs into real numbers in a way that is linear and obeys the product rule. Same here. And on Rn, and again, there is a map induced, which means that every tangent vector has an image in the tangent vector to that point. And I'm stressing all of this because throughout the course and throughout the scientific literature, people often take this for granted. And they will say, oh, this function and that function and this tangent vector. And they write it down with actually explicit functions and actually explicit components of vectors. And what they write down happens here. And what they mean happens here. Right? So we are really interested in describing stuff that happens, for example, on space-time. But then we describe it by means of a chart. And sometimes the line is a little blurred in the linguistic treatment of this. But we should always keep in mind that when we're dealing with explicit functions, explicit coordinates, and so on, it's always over here. And we're, by these means, describing what's really happening over there. So the algebra homomorphism phi star is called the pullback of phi, back because it's this way, and TP of phi, the linear map that maps this tension space into that tension space, is called the pullback of phi star, which is a push forward of phi. Okay, so we have that every point in the manifold has an image or name in Rn, its coordinates. And every function in this function, function germ's algebra, is the image of a function germ over there. And each tangent vector here has an image among the tangent vectors there. And there, we know how to write down the tangent vectors explicitly. Just we know, like we know how to write down vectors explicitly as n tuples. Here, functions as functions from Rn into R. And here, we can write down tangent vectors. My sunglasses just followed the call of gravity. And also here, we have tangent vectors explicitly in terms of components. And in particular, such a tangent vector, an element over here, may be called eta. And that eta is a linear combination of the partial derivatives at this point. No wonder, because it's directional derivatives, right? Every tangent vector is a directional derivative. And these are the directional derivatives in the individual cardinal directions. And any linear combination of these is a directional derivative. So every tangent vector takes this form. So we write down, for example, this tangent vector. And what we may mean, what we really want to describe with it, is this. We take the chart, the existence of the chart, for granted. And we don't always refer to it. Now, in order to obtain the physicist's definition of what is a tangent vector, we now consider a change of chart. So imagine that we have the manifold and a chart that maps differentiably into Rn. So that's what we have here again. But imagine for this manifold, we also have another chart, that we may call alpha. Let's call this chart beta and then this chart alpha, which also maps the points of the manifold, or at least of a chart, of a patch of it, into Rn. So now we have two coordinate systems. We have two charts. A point in the manifold has an image over here as an n-tuple vector, and here too. So the same point can now be referred to by giving two different n-tuples of numbers. Overall, we have, therefore, a map, a differentiable map, that goes, for example, from here all the way to there. And what is it? It's the chart alpha inverse, right? Because we go from here to here, and then beta. So alpha inverse beta, alpha inverse beta, that's a map that goes all the way from phi to here. It's perfectly legitimate map between two differentiable manifolds. Remember, Rn is a differentiable manifold. This Rn is a differentiable manifold. And that's just a diffeomorphism that runs between the two. It's composed of alpha inverse beta. So what happens as we change chart? Well, we have the algebra of function germs on this side, algebra of function germs on that side. And we know that the arrows are reversed, but they're invertible. So we have that we have an algebra homomorphism going from this algebra of function germs to the one on the manifold, and also from here to there. And overall, we get one algebra homomorphism from the algebra of function germs here to the algebra of function germs there. And then on the left-hand side, we have a tangent space to the point in Rn. And here we have the tangent space to that point in Rn. And it just means we have now two ways to describe the same thing that's happening here on the manifold, either using this coordinate system or using that coordinate system, this chart, or that chart. And we notice that we can always jump directly from here to there. right? So there are these induced maps that allow us to jump that way. So this means that every point in the manifold has now two images, one image here and one image there. And the two images are related to each other by a map. Let's make this more explicit. Let's say that this point Q has coordinates x1 to xn in this vector space. And the point S over here, which is another image of that same point on the manifold, has these coordinates that we may call x tilde 1 to x tilde n. So this is the tilded vector space, and this is the untilded vector space. And then we have a diffeomorphism that goes from the untilded ones from here all the way to over there. As we said, it's the alpha inverse. So we can write that the x tilded coordinates are given by phi of the untilded coordinates. So we can map a patch of points here to a patch of points there using this phi map. And what's important to point out here is that we can write down such maps completely explicitly, because this would be just functions where you plug in numbers and you get out numbers. That sort of thing we know very well. It's much harder to write down something from here to there. Sure, you could give this point the name Alfred and the neighboring point Peter or whatever, and then you map them into here, but it's tedious to do it this way, right? On the other hand, if we have a map all the way from Rn to Rn, then we can write down conveniently explicit functions that do that. Now, let's look at the mapping of the function germs. So here we have function germs. How do they map into each other? Now we have that every function germ here, remember, this is the algebra of function germs around the point P. Maybe I should make that visible again. OK, so here's the point P, algebra of function germs. And then this has a pre-image over here and a pre-image over there. And how are they related? Well, you see, what's going on over here is an exact image of what's going on over there. And same is true here. It's an image of what is going on over there, which means in particular that if we take a function f and evaluate it at p, we get a number, let's say 7. And now if we take the function h, which is its image, and also evaluate it at the point s, right? Just like f has to be evaluated at p, h, the image of the function, has to be evaluated at the point s. What value would that output? 7 as well, right? Because it's got to be the image of what's going on over here. And same here. If we take the function germ g, which is the image of f, and apply it to its point q, it too will output 7. And that's not only true at the points. We are talking about function germs. So there exists a neighborhood around Q, a neighborhood around P, a neighborhood around S, a joint neighborhood. As an over, they have a finite overlap where these functions agree. So not just this is the 7 for all three of them, but also in the neighborhood, they completely agree. OK, so this means that if we evaluate f at p, so if we evaluate f at the point p of the manifold, we get the same output number as if we evaluated g at q or h at s. That's an important thing to keep in mind. And that's a general principle, right? If we apply a tangent vector to a, that is to say, a directional derivative to a function, we get a value. And the directional derivative of a function at that point, that value is a number. It could be 11 or whatever. It's got to be the same number here, there, and there, right? OK, so what we have is that the functions, the values of the functions agree. And now let's look at the tangent vectors. I already anticipated it. So we pick a tangent vector in here, xi. The tangent vector in here, abstract business, but we can make it concrete by mapping it into either one of these tangent spaces. So Xi has two images. Under the alpha chart, it has the image eta, and it has, under the beta chart, the image nu. These are tangent vectors in the Rn, tangent vector in Rn. So eta is in tq of Rn. Eta is in tq of Rn, and nu is in ts of the other Rn. Now, by construction, because these maps induce each other, we have, as I said before, that if you apply that tangent vector, that directional derivative, on that g, so if you apply the image of xi to the image of f, then you get a number. It's the value of the directional derivative, eta, applied to the function or function germ g. That's some number like 11. It's the same as what you get when you apply xi to f or nu to h. Always the same value. So let's spell this out. Let's spell out this equation here from here to there. What does it mean that we apply eta to g? Eta is a tangent vector to a point in Rn. So we can write down what this explicitly is. Namely, it has to be an eta I coefficient times the partial derivatives. Right? This is a directional derivative. This is a tangent vector. According to the algebraic definition, it's a directional derivative. And that directional derivative gets applied to the function germ g, right? That's eta of g. And that's to be evaluated at the point q. That gives us a number. And that number has to be the same, or what do you mean, what do I want to say when I say has to be? It is, by construction, the same as if we apply the new tangent vector here, tangent vector nu, to the function germ h. So this tangent vector also has this form, because it's a tangent vector to a point in Rn, where we know how tangent vectors look, where we know how directional derivatives look. So it has to, this is nu, a linear combination of the directional derivatives in the cardinal directions. And this thing is being applied to that function. And remember, that function takes as variables the x tildes, right? This Rn we call the Rn of the x tildes, and that's the Rn of the x's. Right, so we have that this is equal to that. Now remember that the output of the function h at the point x tilde is the same as the output of the function g at the corresponding points x. Right? So it doesn't matter whether you evaluate here or evaluate over there. So h of x of the x tildes, so h of s, is equal to g of x, that is to say g of q. So instead of h of x tilde, we can write here g of x. But then we seem to have a bit of a problem, because we are differentiating with respect to x tilde, which is fine if we write it like this. But if we write it like that, well, then we have here dependence on the x's. So what we need to do is we need to transform, according to the rules that we know from calculus 3, about how to do change of variables for functions from Rn to Rn. We know that these partial derivatives become these partial derivatives, where this is the Jacobian matrix of the change of variables from the x's to the x tildes. So now we've expressed the left-hand side here in terms of the right-hand side. We've expressed the statement that the evaluation of a directional derivative here has to give the same number as over there. And we managed to have the g on the left, on both left and the right. And now we can draw conclusions from this. Namely, since this must be true for all functions g, right, that the evaluation of the directional derivatives gives you the same value. Since it has to be true for all functions g, it has to be true that this directional derivative is that directional derivative. So it has to be true that this is equal to that. Now, remember that these directional derivatives are linearly independent of each other. D by dx1 is not a linear combination of d by dx2 or d by dx3 or something. These are independent directional derivatives. So that means that if this is to be true for each of these directions, we must have that these coefficients agree. So we must have that eta I is equal to the sum over the Jacobian matrix applied to nu. So actually, this is the inverse of the Jacobian of our map phi. Because here we have x as a function of x tilde. X as a function of x tilde. And if I just go back here, right, where is it? Function of the x tilde. Okay, so this is the x tilde side here, right? And this is the x side. So, so what we need is x. So x tilde is a function of the x's, that's the phi, right? So x tilde is phi of x. And then here we have x as a function of x tilde. So therefore, these are the derivatives of phi inverse, right? Phi goes from expresses x tilde as a function of the x's, and phi inverse expresses the x as a function of the x tilde. So that's the Jacobian matrix capital D of phi inverse that arises in here. And of course, we can invert this because that's just the matrix. The inverse matrix is then the Jacobian of the diffeomorphism phi. All right, so what we see here is that we've just calculated how the directional derivative, the coefficients of the directional derivative, I wish I could move things here, how the coefficients of the directional derivatives here transform into the coefficients of the directional derivatives over there. So it's always the same directional derivative. It's always an image of this, right? But the coefficients here can differ from the coefficients there. And how they differ depends on that diffeomorphism between the two. And here we have the equation that describes it. So the summary is manifold, the two charts. There's a map that expresses the x variables in terms that expresses the x tilde variable in terms of the x variables. So we have x tilde of x. Then, given a tangent vector to the point P, we can express it in this chart as eta equal to eta I these partial derivatives. In that chart, we can express the tangent vector. We have an image of the tangent vector, of the same tangent vector, as this linear combination of the d by dx tildes. And the relationship is through this Jacobian matrix. Now, this leads us to the physicist's definition of what is a tangent space. Namely, the physicist's definition of a tangent space, TPM, at the point P of an abstract manifold, differentiable manifold M, is this. A tangent vector, according to the physicist's definition, and that includes Einstein, he did it this way, a tangent vector is a map that assigns to each germ of a chart a coefficient vector Rn such that if these are the coefficients in one chart, and those are the coefficients in the other chart, then they are related by this Jacobian matrix. In other words, we identify tangent vectors as tuples of numbers which behave in a particular way, namely this way, under change of charts. And you see, the disadvantage of this is that it refers to charts. Whereas the algebraic definition simply says linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. Okay, so far we have two definitions of what the tangent space is. So let's say we choose a chart, alpha, and a tangent vector. Then what algebraically this means is that xi is a directional, is represented as a directional derivative in that chart. And the defining property is that it obeys the Leibniz rule, the product rule for derivatives. And the new physicist's definition, I mean, for us in this course, new, is the physicist definition, which says that a tangent vector is an n-tuple, which is just a direction vector. And its defining property is that it changes coefficients in this particular way if you change coordinate system, if you change chart. Any questions so far about the, yeah?
So is it just a working definition? Because if we go deeper as a Gates theory, in the tetrad formulation, this just won't work.
Well, we will get to the tetrad formalism later. And there, the point is not so much how we define the tangent space, but in the tetrad formalism, we will find out that there is enormous amount of freedom in how we choose bases in the tangent spaces, and we will use the freedom to choose these bases arbitrarily. But it's a bit too early to get into these things. Okay, so the geometric definition of a tangent space is the original definition of a tangent space. It's the most intuitive one, where we say that tangent vectors to a tangent vector to a point in a differential manifold is literally the tangent to something, a tangent to a path. So imagine this is our manifold here. This is a point P. And imagine this curved line describes a path in that manifold. It might be parameterized by time. It might be parameterized by something more abstract. Doesn't matter. So there's some parameter and some real number parameter. And as we run through that real number parameter, we go through this path. And we can choose, for example, this parameter, this parameterization of the path to be such that at as the parameter value is 0, we happen to be at the point P. So let us consider paths in M, in the manifold, that pass through the point P. And this path will be parameterized, meaning that there's an input real number, and the output is a point in the manifold. And we choose it in such a way that at the parameter value 0, the path is happening to pass through the point P. Now, what that means is, let me give it an intuition here. Now, let's say we have a we have a tiny little Wi-Fi enabled thermometer, and it's tiny, and I can throw it in this room, and it will have a trajectory. So it will have a path gamma, and let's say gamma of as a function of t, for example, the time. Right? So that would be one of these parameterized curves. And then you could imagine that I pick one point here in space, and I make sure that the trajectory actually passes through that point exactly when it says on the clock, 0 time, right? So it starts at minus half a second and then throw it. It goes to this point P that we singled out, and then it continues on. Now, in this room, there's a temperature function, right? The temperature is going to be higher up here than it is there, and so on. There's a bit of a current. But if you take a snapshot of the temperature distribution, it's some scalar function in space. Some function that you may call f, which is the temperature function, right? It maps for every point in space, you get a temperature. Now, let's combine the trajectory with the temperature function. So I have a trajectory function, gamma of t. And I can ask, as my thermometer is flying let's say it's measuring locally what the temperature is. It's a really good temperature, it's a really good thermometer that can do that. Let's say with measuring the heat radiation or something. So let's say this thermometer flies and it records and broadcasts to us what the temperature is locally where it is flying. Mathematically, what this means is that we have two functions. We have the function gamma, which is describing the trajectory as a function of time. So I plug in the time value, I get the position. And then this position I plug into the temperature function, right? So gamma inputs a number, the time, and outputs the position of the trajectory. And then this position gets entered into the temperature function, and the output is a number again. So overall, that's number to number. It's a function from R into R. At every point in time, I get the temperature that is measured by this gadget as a function of time. So it's actually a map from R into R, right? Now imagine that somebody else, one of you, also has one of these flying thermometers and throws it in such a way that it also goes through this point P. Now, that gives us another function here. And there can be many ways of doing this. Now, two such paths, gamma A and gamma B, which are all going through the point P at the same time, at time equal to zero, so every one of us is throwing, you know, exactly through that particular point here. Two of these paths are called equivalent if they record the same change of temperature for all possible temperature functions. What this means is that, let me just anticipate already, what this means is that two paths are called equivalent if they have the exact same velocity vector as they pass through the point. Because it's the velocity vector as they pass through the critical point there, where t is equal to zero, that velocity vector determines what rate of temperature change they will record. If they go through it fast, they get a faster change of temperature as if they go slow, even if they have the same direction. If they come in a different direction, obviously they can have different temperature changes also. But the point is that if and only if two trajectories give you the same temperature change at this point, no matter what the temperature field is, then we have that the two trajectories have the same velocity. So we call them equivalent. I mean, that's the intuition, right? So we simply call two of these trajectories equivalent if for all temperature value functions f, we have that if we differentiate this function f after gamma, so that's the temperature reading at the time equal to zero, we get the same for one trajectory as we get for the other trajectory. At this point, you may wonder, why don't we just say that two paths are equivalent if they have the same derivative, the same velocity vector there? Since this is what we mean. But the point is we want to define what is a tangent vector, right? So we cannot start by saying that they have to have the same tangent vector. So we say that two trajectories are equivalent if they always agree on what the range, what the rate of change of the temperature is, even if you know, there was a different temperature field in here. And then, so the intuition is that any such paths are paths that happen to have the same velocity as they go through that point. These trajectories might differ elsewhere, before and after, but as they go through the point in question, they have the same velocity there. And so the geometric definition of the tangent space is that it is the set of these equivalence classes of differentiable paths through P. So it's a set of equivalence classes of paths which agree on the velocity that they have as they go through that point. Now, we may wonder, is this really an equivalent definition? can we show that this is equivalent, for example, to the algebraic definition of the tangent space? After all, we went about it somewhat differently. And so let's prove this. So let's take one of these paths, gamma, and what we can do is, given such a path, given such a trajectory, we can define, we can show that it corresponds to an element of the tangent vector space according to the algebraic definition. Remember, according to the algebraic definition, a tangent vector is a linear map to the Bessel Leibniz rule. But gamma is not a linear map that obeys the Leibniz rule. Gamma is a trajectory. So let's see how they correspond. So what we now observe is the following. If we take one of those trajectories, then we can use it to define a linear map. Let's call it gamma bar. And gamma bar will map functions or function germs into the real numbers. And then we would just have to show that it does that in a way that obeys the Leibniz rule. So first of all, we define, from using the trajectory, we define a map that takes functions and maps them into numbers. How? Well, we take this function, could be a temperature function or any scalar function. So gamma bar takes this function and maps it into, we take the trajectory, plug it into that function, and then take the derivative with respect to the parameter at the value t equal to 0, which means at the point p. So this indeed takes in a function or function germ and outputs a number. Question is it obeying the Leibniz rule? Let's see. So now we take the same path again. And we define this linear map, gamma bar, but we apply it to the product of two functions, two scalar functions. So f is a function from the manifold to R, and g is a function from the manifold to R. So the product is a function from the manifold to R. And now we apply this operation to it. Namely, we take d by dt of the product of these two functions, evaluated at the output of the trajectory. And this is, by definition, what we get when we take the derivative of the product of those two functions evaluated along the path. But the time derivative, or t derivative, of the product of two functions by the Leibniz rule of ordinary calculus obeys the Leibniz rule, right? So we differentiate the first, evaluate the second only, or we evaluate the first and differentiate the second function, all of this at the point t equal to 0, which is to say at the point where we consider the tangent space. So what we showed is that for every trajectory, differentiable trajectory, we can define a map which is linear and goes from the function space into the real numbers and obeys the Leibniz rule, and hence we have a correspondence. For any trajectory, we have such a algebraic tangent vector. And of course, we also have to check, is this true for, do we get the same value for all gammas in the same equivalence class? And we do, right? Because that's exactly the point. All the gammas in the same equivalence class will evaluate this in the same way by construction. Okay, so now we have the geometric definition of tangent spaces, the physicist definition, and the algebraic definition. Before we move on, any questions?
Is there any specific reason we are using the term path over here, rather than curve? Or there's no particular reason?
No, I'm using them synonymously. So it's path or trajectory.
I thought because it's an abstract manifold, that's why we are not using the term curve, maybe, or so?
Well, yeah, I think I try to avoid the term curve because it sounds like curvature. And that will be reserved for a multidimensional thing. So I'll use the term trajectory or path. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah. Are there functions that exist that obey the Leibniz rule that don't require a derivative? Like, there we got the Leibniz rule kind of because of the derivative.
Yes, that's right. So, good question. We will often have to define derivatives. In this course, you will encounter a lot of different kinds of derivatives, and some of them, I should be more precise, we won't call them derivatives, we will call them derivations. And some of the derivations do not arise from a Newton-Leibniz limit. Right? So they don't trace back to an analytic derivation. For example, the inner derivation will come up in a few lectures, and it has nothing to do with Newton-Leibniz. Okay, cotangent space. Now, is everybody familiar with the notion of a dual vector space? Or would anybody like to see a quick review of that? No? Everybody good? Let me still give a very, very quick review, though, just to have it all spelled out. For me, this was an important concept. When I was an undergrad and did linear algebra and the topic of dual vector space came up, I think that was the first time when it clicked in my mind and I really understood what math is about. Because it's a really beautiful concept. So let's remember, given an n-dimensional vector space V, could be, let's say, five-dimensional, then the set of linear maps from that vector space into the real numbers also forms an n-dimensional vector space. And it is called a dual vector space, and it's denoted by V star. So if you're given any vector space, let's say n-dimensional, and now you consider the linear maps, the set of linear maps that take as input a vector from our vector space V, and output a real number in a linear fashion, then these linear maps form themselves a vector space. Right? Because if you have two of them, you can add them. And as you get another one of those maps, you can also multiply by 7, and you also get the linear map out of this. So there is this dual vector space. And for finite dimensions, it's isomorphic to the vector space that we started with. In infinite dimensions, not really. There are some subtleties. But for finite dimensions, same dimension. So that's the dual space V star. And you see, that definition makes it very clear that vector spaces have nothing to do with arrows, for example, right? It's just, what is a vector space? It's an abstract structure, right? It's defined through its properties. Remember, just like last time I explained, that the exponential function can be described through its properties, right? Namely, that it's the only function that is equal to its derivative, and when evaluated at 0, gives you 1. Or you can write it down concretely, right? And similarly with the notion of vector space. You can describe vector spaces through their properties. Namely, they have to be a set, there has to be an addition, and the multiplication with numbers, such that if you add any two, you get another one element of this space. If you multiply with a number, you get another element of this space, right? So these are the axioms, these are the properties. And then you can also ask for concrete examples of this, such as R3 or R100 and so on. And so here what we see is that the notion of vector space is really completely abstract, right? It's just any set that has an addition and a multiplication with numbers obeying these simple axioms is called a vector space. This could be, for example, a set of polynomials. Because you can add two polynomials, get a polynomial. You can take a polynomial, multiply by 7, it's still a polynomial. Bang, you have a vector space of polynomials. Or any other functions, or equations, lots of stuff that form vector spaces very naturally. And in particular, the linear maps from a vector space into the real numbers also form a vector space. And it happens to have the same dimension. It's the dual space. And we will denote it with V star. Okay, and in the case of the tangent space, its dual space will be called TP of M star, and we speak of it as the cotangent space. (Clears throat) then one may ask, okay, what do we have in that cotangent space? How can we generate, how can we write down an element of the cotangent space to a point? We know how we can write down elements of the tangent space. They're all directional derivatives, linear combinations of the d by dxi, which also means that the d by dxi can be viewed as basis vectors. Because any directional derivative is a linear combination of the d by dxi. But what about the cotangent space? Now it turns out that for the cotangent space, there is a similarly simple way of writing down what its elements are, or how to generate a basis for it, and so on. And for that, I would like to start with something clarifying here. Those of you who come from the physics side, maybe not those of you who come from the math side, but those of you who come from the physics side will have heard of differentials. Right? So for example, you have a function f of x1, x2, x3, and then you write down the differential, the so-called differential, x1, x2, x3, and then this is df by dx1, dx1 plus df dx2, dx2 plus df by dx3, dx3. And then you may have been told that you should view these things as deltas, as infinitesimals, as small distances or something like that, right? So it's like a small change of f is equal to df by dx1, and then a small change of x1, etc. It all sounds very wishy-washy when you first hear about it, and it is, but there are historical reasons for why this was done in this way, but I'd like you to forget all about this. If this rang a bell, forget about it, because we'll do it the proper way now. If it didn't ring a bell, then just forget that you saw this, okay?
Thermodynamics?
Yeah, thermodynamics, all over the place. Yeah, being used. But actually, we need differential geometry to identify what these so supposed differentials, like dx1, what that is really, right? So now we will do that properly. And it is arising, these are arising when we are looking for elements of the cotangent space. So imagine that we have a germ of a function at P. So F is an element of the algebra of function germs around P. Then to F, we can associate its so-called differential df. And that df is not some wishy-washy little bit of infinitesimal thing. No, the df is an element of the cotangent space. Right? So for every function, we get an element of the cotangent space. And it will be called a differential of f. Okay, so from the function, we get an element of the cotangent space. What is an element of the cotangent space? It's a map that takes in a tangent vector and spits out a number in a linear way, right? That's an element of the dual space, right? It takes an element of the tangent space and then linearly maps that into a number. Okay, and how do we do that? Well, df is the tangent vector that does the following. It takes in a tangent vector. It's a cotangent vector that does the following. It takes in a tangent vector, outputs a number in a linear fashion in the following way. Df takes in a tangent vector that we may call xi and maps it into the number that you obtain when you calculate the directional derivative xi of f. That's going to be a number and linear too. Okay? So df, the differential, maps tangent vectors into numbers. Namely, tangent vector gets mapped into the directional derivative of f. Okay, so since this is a linear map, this is an element of the cotangent space. And later we will find out that there are particular choices of f that are very interesting. For example, f could be the function which maps all points into their first coordinate, or that map all points into their second coordinate, and so on. So these are the so-called coordinate functions. Then we have dx1, dx2, dx3. These are all elements of the cotangent vector space. And they operate by applying a tangent vector to these coordinate functions. It turns out that the dxi will be the dual basis to the basis of the d by dxi, the basis of the tangent space. I'm just anticipating we will do this concretely now. Okay, so concretely, in a coordinate system, that is to say in a chart, because remember, we always have that actually what we're doing is happening on the differential manifold. But we map everything using a chart in such a way that it appears to happen on Rn. Okay, so concretely now, in a coordinate system, so we take the abstract stuff and image it onto Rn. So concretely, in a coordinate system, in a chart, we have that the abstract tangent vector to a point, P, and an abstract function that lives on the manifold correspond to or have the image eta in the coordinate system and also a function g in that coordinate system. Then dg, the differential of g, is an element of the dual vector space. It maps a tangent vector. Now all of this is happening on the chart side. It maps a tangent vector to a point in Rn into R. And how does it do it? It takes a tangent vector and maps it into the the number that you get when you calculate the directional derivative, eta, of that function g. And since we have now used a chart, remember here, I was not referring to a chart. That's the abstract definition. Here now, I'm referring to a chart. The advantage is that now we're not getting stuck here. We can continue. We can say, aha, we have eta of g. Eta of g is the same as psi of f, right? Because eta is the image of psi, and g is the image of f, right? But this we can now explicitly write down, because eta is a directional derivative. So it takes this form. And then the g is an explicit function of the coordinates x1 to xn. So this is now ready to be evaluated. And now before we move on, let me remind you that the tangent space has a natural basis. So if psi is a direction vector, is a tangent vector to the point, it takes this form. And as we just discussed a few minutes before, this means that every tangent vector is a linear combination. The eta I are the linear combination coefficients of these directional derivatives in the cardinal directions. So that means that a basis of the tangent space in the algebraic definition of tangent space is given by these directional derivatives, right? So these guys are basis vectors of the tangent space. And now, having this, we can ask, what are basis vectors in the cotangent space? So let's find the so-called dual basis of that basis. For that, let's consider the coordinate functions, right? So remember we said that for every function f, we can calculate its differential. And for these functions f, we can also choose the coordinate functions, which map all points to their i's coordinate, or k's coordinate. So let's consider those functions. Let's say the function xk, so it's the k's coordinate. This is not x to the k's power, right? This is the k's coordinate. And so what is its differential? Well, the differential of the function xk to the k's coordinate function is an element of the dual vector space. And as such, it maps tangent vectors into R. And how does it do it? Well, as a cotangent vector, it maps, in particular, this tangent vector I can choose whatever tangent vector I want, right? It maps this tangent vector into the directional derivative of that function. But that's just Kronecker IK. And this means that the dxk are the dual bases to the d by dxi. Dual basis means exactly this. It means that if we take the basis in the cotangent vector space and apply it to the basis in the tangent vector space, then the basis vectors evaluated on each other have a Kronecker delta ik. So for every basis vector here, there's a basis vector over there. So the dual basis vector to d by dx1 is the differential dx1. And then the dual basis vector to d by dx2 is the differential dx2. And if you evaluate them onto another, then they always evaluate to 1. But for example, if you evaluate the d by dx3 on the dx2, then you get a 0, right? Because the evaluation is d by dx2 of x1, and then that's 0. OK, so what that means is, and I'm taking here for granted, and I'm hoping you remember this, that the dual vector space of a finite dimensional vector space always has the same dimension. So we have identified now a set of basis vectors that are dual to these basis vectors, the same number. So these guys are a basis in the dual vector space. There cannot be any other ones because we already found enough of them. And this is important information, because it means that every vector in the cotangent space is a linear combination of these. Right? So every vector in the cotangent space is a linear combination of the dxi with some coefficients. And how does such a vector act? So we can now write down an arbitrary, completely generic vector in the cotangent space. It must take this form. It's a linear combination of the dxi, because they form a basis, with coefficients omega I. Let's evaluate it on a tangent vector. Remember, that's the job of the cotangent vectors. They feed on tangent vectors and output a number linearly. So we take this generic cotangent vector and apply it to a tangent vector. So we apply omega onto a tangent vector to get a number. So we apply omega to a concrete tangent vector, namely this one, let's say. So every tangent vector can be written in this form because these are the basis vectors, right? So we apply omega onto a tangent vector to obtain what? Well, so what we do is we apply this cotangent vector to this tangent vector. But remember how that works. It works by applying the tangent vector to the function omega I xi, right? It means that we apply this tangent vector to the function that's represented here, right? So for the dxi, if it was just the dxi, dxi of this is that directional derivative applied to xi, right? Remember how it works? The differential works on a tangent vector by taking the tangent vector, applying it to the function that it stems from. In this case, the function is xi. So we apply that. And then it's just by linearity that we can continue it in this way. So what that means is that the d by dxi will act on the x, d by dxj act on the xi, which gives us a Kronecker delta. And so overall, what we can conclude is that one of these sums goes away because we have a Kronecker delta, and we just have the sum over the omega I eta I. So the conclusion is that every cotangent vector takes this form for some coefficients. And if we apply it to a generic tangent vector, then the number that we get is simply this. Right, so we apply a generic omega on a generic tangent vector, and then what we get is the sum over the omega I eta I. Now, remember that for every function, we get a differential, which is a cotangent vector. So now let's say we are looking at functions that are more complicated, that are not just coordinate functions, but some really complicated function on the manifold. Then what is its cotangent vector? What is its differential at some given point? Well, it's got to be of that form, right? With the omega I some numbers. But what numbers might they be? Okay, so let's choose some function on the manifold. Remember, I'm writing here g and at the point q. But that's because we are working on the image of the abstract stuff in a chart. We're really interested at the point p on a differentiable manifold, and then some function f in the neighborhood. But these are just the images of it. For the moment, I will try to remind you of that. But of course, it's tedious to always say it in this way. And at some point, we will just take it for granted. And when we do something in a chart, what we're really talking about is the abstract thing. So let's say we choose an arbitrary function. And then we say, well, it has a differential. It has a cotangent vector associated to it at the point q. And we know that this differential has to be of this form. So then the question is, what might these omega k be, these coefficients? How do we calculate them? Well, let's see. We have that the differential is a cotangent vector. It takes a tangent vector as input, outputs a number. How does it do it? Well, it's obtained by taking the tangent vector, that is to say the directional derivative, and evaluate it on the function in question, which is, if you remember, it's the directional derivative, this is this, applied to the function in question, that's the g, it's this. Now, let us compare this equation with that equation. What we see here is that if we take an arbitrary cotangent vector and apply it to a tangent vector, then the number that we get is this. And here we saw that if we take this cotangent vector and apply it to eta, then we obtain that. Notice, here is sum over omega I eta I. Sum over eta I this. Those guys must be the omega I. Right? These must be the omega I because that's the evaluation of omega on the tangent vector. That's our omega here applied to a tangent vector. So these must be the omega I. This must be those coefficients. So the omega I are these. And therefore, we obtain that the differential of a function g is this linear combination of the partial derivatives evaluated at the point dxi. Hence, this business that I asked you to remember or maybe not remember of, if you have a function f of x1 and x2, then, in thermodynamics or some other fields, you would write down a differential and say that this is df dx1 dx1 plus df dx2 dx2. And then yada yada, somehow these are infinitesimal elements or whatever. They're not, right? What's really happening is that this is a basis vector of the cotangent space. That's a basis vector of the cotangent space. This is some vector of the cotangent space. And these are the coefficients, right? Basis vector, coefficient, coefficient. And that's a generic basis vector, a generic vector of the tangent space. All right. And then here I'm formulating an exercise that I suggest you do. Don't have to hand that in or anything. And the exercise is to reconsider the physicist's definition of a tangent vector. Remember, tangent vector is any n-tuple that transforms in this particular way with the Jacobian of phi inverse under change of chart. And now we found out what a cotangent vector is. Find out how the coefficients of a cotangent vector change as you change chart. This used to be important because Einstein and others were still defining tangent and cotangent vectors through their transformation properties under changes of coordinates. And you have now all the tools to work out what the change of coordinates is. It's in fact this one, so you know what you shoot for, right? And that is the definition, the physicist definition of what a cotangent vector is. The point here is that the coefficients of a cotangent vector change under the inverse of the previous Jacobian matrix. So it's actually the Jacobian matrix of phi. Okay. Now, let's do a little bit of notation and terminology. The elements of the tangent vector space are called contravariant vectors. The elements of the cotangent space are called covariant vectors. And symbolically, one often writes that the tangent vector to the manifold takes this form when the tangent vector is a tangent vector on the manifold, even though in reality we have to specify a chart so that we know what this means, because these guys are only defined on Rn, right? And similarly, for elements of the cotangent space, in principle, only in the chart can you write down this, but people will often omit saying that they chose a chart. Okay, at this point, we are ready to define tensors. What is a tensor? A tensor is an element of the tensor product of arbitrarily many copies of the tangent vector space and arbitrarily many copies of the cotangent vector space. So an RS tensor is an element of the tensor product of R factors of contravariant vector spaces and S factors, S tensor factors of covariant vector spaces. And in a chart, very concretely, this means that such a tensor, such an SR tensor, S and R are positive integers, in a chart, it means that such a tensor T is a linear combination of these basis vectors, right? These guys form a basis in one tangent space. If you take lots of them, you get a basis in the tensor product of these tangent spaces, and similarly with the cotangent spaces. And these are just linear combination coefficients. All of this, remember, happens at a point, right? So we define we defined the tangent space at a point, the cotangent space at a point, and now the tensor space at a point. Hence, the P over here is always referring to the fact that we are doing this at a point. And under a change of chart, these guys transform just in such a way that every tangent vector index transforms with a Jacobian of phi inverse, and every cotangent vector index transforms according to the Jacobian of phi. It's, all of this is just linear combinations and more linear combinations. And special cases are the tensor space of S equal to 0 and R equal to 1. In this case, we have just one of these and nothing else. In other words, T, P of M with just superscript 1 is the tangent space. And the cotangent space is obtained by having the 1 downstairs. And we have just one of them. So this cotangent space is the tensor space with 0 up here and 1 down there. In other words, a tangent vector is a tensor of rank 1, 0. So it has a 1 here and a 0 there. And a cotangent vector is a tensor of rank 0, 1. So it has a 0 here and a 1 there. Now, all of this, what we did so far today, or up to today, was local. We considered tangent vectors and cotangent vectors and tensors to a point of the manifold. Now, let's go from local to global. And I will go very, it's just a brief overview of things. Okay, so we call the union of all pairs of points and their tangent spaces, we call that the tangent bundle belonging to that manifold. And it is itself a manifold. It has double the dimension because the set of all p's is an n-dimensional manifold. And then attached to each one of them is a tangent space, which has also n dimensions. This tangent bundle is also called the total space. The original manifold is called the base space. And each of these tangent spaces, of course, are just isomorphic to Rn. So the non-trivial piece is in the manifold. And the tangent spaces are all the same. The tangent spaces are all isomorphic to Rn. These tangent spaces that we attach are called a fiber, right? So this is a base point of the tangent bundle. And this tangent space is a fiber. I'm just giving names, right? It's just definitions so far. And since they are all isomorphic to one another, all of these tangent spaces have dimension n, so they're all isomorphic to Rn, we call Rn the standard fiber. And I suppose you see where this is going. You could also consider other fiber bundles, not just a tangent bundle, but you could also consider, for example, the cotangent bundle, where you have the union of all pairs where you choose a point on the manifold and its cotangent vector. Or tensors. You have an RS tensor bundle. And more generally, there are bundles for isospinners that describe nuclear force, for example, or the weak force. That would be vector bundles. And then there are gauge groups as bundles. Gauge groups here, such as U3 or GL3. We will keep this at a minimum in this course. The reason is a curious one. General relativity allows for non-triviality globally of space-time. Space-time could be a donut. Space-time could be a pretzel. And if it were, we would need all of this machinery in quite some detail. General relativity would allow that. For some reason, nature doesn't seem to choose to do that. So unless we are forced to do that, unless we find that space-time is a donut, we don't really need that. Of course, this fiber bundle technology is used in other contexts, such as QCD. But that's not our topic in this course. So I just want to give you a bit of a flavor of what can happen as you go from local to global. It's not trivial.
So I have a question. Like, the fiber has to be a vector space, right?
No, it doesn't have to be a vector space. It could
the
also
group
be a group.
Be like groups, right?
Yeah, okay. And I'll give you an example of how that comes up. Okay, further definitions. When you take your tangent bundle, you can define the map pi, which will simply forget that, which will forget this part. So the map which takes your tangent bundle and just gives you the manifold back. So that's a map, which is called the bundle projection, which takes as input these pairs of p and the tangent space, and it just gives you p back. That's the bundle projection. And then a section, sigma, a section of such a tangent bundle is a map which is a continuous right inverse of that, which is to say it gives you, for every point, a tangent vector. And if you applied the pi to it, you would just get the point back. Let me give you examples or some more explanation on this. Do you remember what a graph of a function is? I suppose you remember it intuitively, but it comes up in this context. So if you have a function f of x, then what might be its graph? The graph of f is the set of all pairs x and f of x for f of x for all x in the domain of f, right? So you can visualize it then in this way, right? But what we mean by the graph, mathematically speaking, is not the picture. It's what the picture represents, which is the set of pairs of an x value and an f value, an x value and an f value, right? So that's really the graph. And you may recognize it in what we've just said. So for example, so what we have is that the graph of a field, of what we speak of physically of a field, is a section of its fiber bundle. OK, so what do we mean by fields? A tangent vector field is a map, psi, which maps points of the manifold into tangent vectors at that point. In a chart, a tangent vector field is an expression like this, where at every point of the manifold, these are the basis vectors. And then we have here the coefficients. Previously, just up until like 3 minutes ago, these were just numbers. But that's because we considered the tangent vectors to a point. Now we are considering a tangent vector field, so a tangent vector everywhere on the manifold. And so these coefficients will change from point to point in the manifold. So we have here coefficient functions. And similarly, a cotangent vector field.
Do you all require like the coefficient functions vary smoothly from point to point?
We don't require them to change, but they can.
Yeah, I think there is a requirement that like the coefficient functions should vary smoothly.
Oh, you mean conditions on that? Yes, if we yes, it depends. In this course, we will always assume that when we differentiate, that we will have previously assumed that it's differentiable. If for GR, this is a perfectly reasonable assumption. OK, so cotangent vector fields are maps which map a point, which map each point in the manifold into a cotangent. For every point of the manifold, they give you a cotangent vector at that point, right? And similarly for tensor fields, where for every point we get a tensor in that tensor space to that point. And then the graph of these fields are a section of the corresponding fiber bundle of the tangent bundle, the cotangent bundle, or the tensor bundle. Now, why talk about fiber bundles then? What's the power of them? A power that the mathematics and GR, just a sec, a power that the mathematics and that GR allows, but that nature for some reason doesn't seem to make use of. Yeah.
Oh, it's past 3:20. So.
Yes, I know. I'm trying to, I'm trying to wrap it up. I think it's this and then one more.
I just know you have a lecture. So.
Yeah, I'll make it there. I have a fast scooter. I'll drive like there's no tomorrow. OK, so why fiber bundles? Well, so fiber bundles are by definition required to be locally trivial. So that means locally, we should always be able, that is to say, there should always exist patches such that in such a patch, let's call it U. And there will be multiple patches, so we index them with UR so that they cover together, they cover the entire manifold, such that the fiber bundle over that patch is actually just a Cartesian product between the region and Rn. Do you know what that means, Cartesian product? It means just set of pairs, right? If you consider the tensor product, then you assume making assumptions of linearity. But if you just consider pairs, such as a point and a tangent vector that belongs to it, right, then you're not assuming that you can multiply the point with a tangent vector or something like this. It's just pairs, right? That's what is indicated by this Cartesian product cross. So the tangent bundle can be viewed as a set of pairs of points with vectors Rn, right? That is to say, there is an isomorphism that allows us to map differentiably, isomorphically, locally that that bundle into the tangent bundle into this Cartesian product, so that it's really just a manifold in NDRN in this way, and it's locally always true. However, we allow the fiber bundles to be globally non-trivial. Here's an example: a manifold with a hole could be donut, something like this. And now imagine this is one region, and that is another region, and we have some overlap between the two. Now, over region U1, the fiber bundle is just this. There's an isomorphism to this. Over that region, too, there's an isomorphism to just that. However, there is no reason that the isomorphisms that map into this actually agree here. It's like you have a Möbius band, right? So you can have a global, you can have a global change, and that global change means that overall the entire fiber bundle doesn't have an isomorphism that makes it just that. Just the regions do, but together it doesn't have that. And then you have a non-triviality here, and that's in fact a method to detect that the manifold has holes. Because if it didn't have that, it couldn't have this non-triviality property. So for some reason, nature doesn't seem to make use of the possibility that space-time might be a pretzel, but maybe it's to the better. Okay, and then just a final comment, which is that, remember, the tangent vectors were defined as derivations. Right? The tangent, according to the algebraic definition, they are derivations, they are linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule. Tangent vectors were directional derivatives in this sense, because the directional derivatives are linear maps that obey the Leibniz rule at a point. And now this is just to say that if we now look at the global picture, we have the set of all functions on the manifold, f of m. These are no longer just the function germs, but just functions. At least once differentiable. Or in this case, yeah, we choose the C infinity functions so that we get an algebra of the C infinity functions on the manifold. And then one can show that the contravariant vector fields, and that's a vector space that's way larger than just the vector space of one tangent space, right? So the space of the contravariant vector fields is the set of derivations of the algebra of the C infinity functions on the manifold. And so what that means is that if psi is a vector field acting not just at a point but everywhere, it's a contravariant vector field, then it can act on a function that acts everywhere, mapping that into a number everywhere. So therefore, it's mapping a function into function. Previously, it was just mapping functions into number at the point, at the point P, right? But since we do that everywhere, a tangent vector is actually mapping functions into functions, scalar functions into scalar functions, which will be important later because it means you can apply them repeatedly, right? One tangent vector after another. Okay, and that can be shown to obey the Leibniz rule. And so therefore, we have that the globally speaking, the contravariant vector fields are the derivations of the algebra of the smooth scalar functions on the manifold. Yeah, and then what we will do next is differential forms. You've already seen differential forms, I just didn't call them differential forms. For example, the set of functions on the manifold is actually called the set of zero forms. The set of cotangent vector fields, T of M star, the set of cotangent vector fields is actually the set of one forms. And now we will just have to define all the other forms as well. And this is as far as we get today.